It's difficult to introduce a person whose every action, whose every thought, every effort is directed toward the betterment and the furtherance of our way of life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying this off the cuff. I've talked to many, many alcoholics who belong to AA in South Carolina, and I've gotten this impression. I'm sure it's a firm one. It's difficult to introduce somebody like that, so it's only sufficient to say that through his example, his devotion, and his leadership, that he's gained the trust of the alcoholics who are sober in South Carolina to the extent that he's been elected to the highest office AA can bestow in any state. Ladies and gentlemen, I present at this time Lloyd G. of Spartanburg, state delegate from the state of South Carolina.
Thank you, Tom. I was sitting there. This is so amusing to me. Your new state area delegate, I believe you call in Georgia, John, I was thinking what a chance he was taking inviting me down as your speaker. It sort of reminds me of the drunk that was visiting a brewery, and his buddy fell in the bed of beer and drowned. So the other fellow had to go. It was his sad duty to go and tell the man's wife that her husband had drowned. So when he did, the wife was distressed and said, "Oh, my poor husband," says, "poor Jerry never had a chance." So the other guy said, "Well," said, "I don't know so much about that." Said, "I think he had a pretty good chance." Said he came up twice and went to the bathroom before he finally drowned. My name is Lloyd Gardner. I am a grateful alcoholic today. This is a tremendous pleasure to be invited down here. I am sort of the kind of speaker, I think, that when I arrive, very few people say hello, and when I leave, everybody says goodbye. I am the delegate of South Carolina. I'm brand new. I have a lot to learn. And I started trying to learn several weeks ago when I cornered John off and started asking questions, and Bob and some of the others. And they have been most helpful. And I also went so far as to check in General Service Headquarters, and I found out that Georgia is at the top of the list in the United States, and they're doing a tremendous job towards combating the alcoholic illness. So I think that is wonderful that I can say that about the state of Georgia. We have always enjoyed visiting the groups in Georgia, Evelyn and I, my wife. We missed very few state conventions, and we enjoyed the Southeastern in Atlanta. All we alcoholics really have is our story, and I can't dress mine up because I wouldn't know how. I tried to tell you strictly from the cuff what happened, and in the hope that it may get through to someone that may be not as fortunate as I have been. I have a wife, and we have two daughters, and I hope you'll forgive me if I mention during my little talk several times my daughters, because they have played such a vital part in a happy sobriety to me that I will have to mention them in my story from time to time. My drinking did not start at the early age that so many people will tell you from the podium. Actually, I did not start drinking until I was in my 30s. Neither did I come from a Christian, church-going, religious family. I came from a broken family, and I wonder sometimes if this perhaps may have caused me to be a potential alcoholic. I remember so well, there were four brothers in our family, and many nights, now don't get me wrong, I loved my parents dearly, but many nights we would stay awake most of the night, sitting on the steps, wondering what was going to happen next, whether one or the other would kill the other. So I think perhaps I grew up with an inferiority complex that may have, I don't know for sure, caused me in later years to sort of get hooked on alcohol. I tried to do the things in life that most people are expected to do later after becoming a grown. I attended church regularly. I met my wife in church. Both of us had Sunday school classes at the time. We were married, and we lived happy for a long, long time. A few years later, I started drinking sociably, if there is such a thing. And before long, I was on the way to becoming a chronic alcoholic. Now, these friends I was drinking with mostly were people that were in a position to help me in my particular line of work. And they continued to drink, and we would go on fishing trips together and have a good time. And like I say, being the insidious and progressive illness that it is, it wasn't long until I became a person who could not make a decision and was completely powerless over alcohol. This continued, and things got worse, of course. And we used to think the way I really started, I would drink about a half a pint in the evening after 5 o'clock. And of course, you know how that is. It gets worse, and then I had to increase my to a pint. And later on, a pint and a half. And eventually, I got to where I was drinking a fifth. And that's not a lot compared with what some of you have drank, probably. But to me, it was. And I'm going to try not to go into a long drunkalogue because I don't think it's necessary. But during the time I was doing this drinking so much, our daughters, their names, Brenda and Melanie, and they were in elementary school about this time. And I recall so often when they would come home from school, never would they come in the house with their friends or bring their friends until they came in first and checked to see if I was lying on the floor or if I was passed out or if I had shot the house up or something like that. So this grew. My wife had to work. In fact, we had to have something to live on, so she had to work in order to keep the family going. Many, many times, Evelyn would have to take the girls at night to a motel, or perhaps to their grandmother's. And it's really sad when you think of it. You see two little children grabbing up their school books and their clothes, and probably on a cold night, having to go out to find a place to sleep. And that's what happened in our life. Things continued to get worse, and eventually I was introduced to the rest homes. And every time I pass through Lawrence, South Carolina, it reminds me of what I refer to as my old alma mater, the Lawrence Rest Home, which is closed now. In fact, we were down this way not too long ago, and going back, we made a special trip just to go by and look at the old place. And the house is still there, but the rest home is closed. Things continued to get worse and worse. My wife's health was impaired. Many times Evelyn would have to had to go to the doctor many times to sort of have her nerves checked out and do something about them. And if things grew worse, I can think back now what really the stages I was going through. I believe the four stages that meant a whole lot in my life towards becoming an alcoholic were, of course, the social drinking, and then the morning drink, and of course that was the drink I had to have before I could even get started in the morning to work. Next in my life, I think the blackout stages came, so often I would function normally one night and probably the next morning not even know what I had done. And of course, the fourth stage in my life was the extreme compulsive drinking stage, and that was when I had to drink to live. So I was in a stage where it looked like I was completely gone until a man working for me had been in AA 4 months, and he came to me and he says, "Lord," says, by the way, this man was a former employee of the Southern Railway, and he was a real talented man, and he had been groomed to be a vice president, but he lost his job, and finally he was able to get in AA. So when he approached me, he said, "I've been in 4 months," and said, "That's the longest period of sobriety I have had in 40 years. So he says, "You don't have to sign your life away," or said, "I'd just like for you to come down and observe." So I went down, and this little hole in the wall had probably 12 or 15 members. And it just so happened that I knew four or five of them. And I was introduced to the others. And before or after the meeting was over, I felt like a different person. I had been in a shell for so many years, living in a hell and not knowing which way to turn and thinking that there was no help whatsoever. And these people were reaching out and lending a hand for me to come in and help myself. And they were also willing to help me. So I unfortunately had trouble immediately after coming into our fellowship. And I stayed away because I felt guilty and I didn't want to go back. And one day, one of the old members came by my place and says, in fact, he was one of the founders of one of the groups in our community. He says, "Lord," says, "how about coming on back to AA?" Says, at that time, he says, "We have 250,000 members." And says, "It'll work for those people." Says, "I believe it'll work for you." So he went on to give a little illustration. He says, "Work it one day at a time, like we're taught so much." Says, that makes it easier, and says, I believe you can make it. And he says, "For instance, if you wanted to move a telephone pole lying on the ground from one side of the street to the other," he said, "that would be an impossibility. But," he said, "if you take a chainsaw and you cut that telephone pole into 1 foot lengths," he says, "you can move it one length at a time," and says, "you can move it all the way across." So that made sense. So I started back to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they also told me, "If you're going to have any degree of success in this fellowship, you're going to have to feel and be a part of it." And by that, he also stressed the fact that there was work to be done in a group. He said there are ashtrays to be emptied and the floors to be cleaned and chairs straightened and everything we have to do, cups and like that and coffee to make. So I started doing that. And so often during the meetings, I would interrupt the old timers and ask questions because this everything to me was so foreign, like so many of the words I couldn't even pronounce. It took me a long time to learn to say anonymity and other words. This I started picking up a little degree of sobriety, happy sobriety, and everything seemed to be moving along pretty good. And somebody came along about that time, and they would always refer to this as a fellowship, and then somebody else would refer to it as an organization, and that was confusing. And one man says, "Well," said, "I'll tell you what a fellowship is." Says this old couple said they were getting up in years, and they were retired, and they wanted to move out on a farm, but they wanted to grow some chickens and some hogs to supplement their income. So they moved out and they built a hog pen and they bought an old sow. And every morning the old man would go out to the hog pen and see if there were any little pigs. So it happened that this went on for several days, probably a week or two, and no little pigs. So they called the vet and asked him if he would check the sow and see if she was sick. And he says no. After checking this, said, "No, she's not sick," but said, "All this sow needs is fellowship." So he says, "I would suggest you take this old sow over to your farmers, your neighbor farmers, and let the sow have fellowship," and said, "I believe you'll have some little pigs." So this old man got a wheelbarrow, and he loaded the old sow up, and he hauled her over to the Deal farm and left her all day, and then he got his wheelbarrow and carried her back. And the next morning he goes out and to look and see if they had any little pigs, and there were no little pigs. So the next day he loaded the old sow up in the wheelbarrow and carried it over, I think probably to the McCracken farm or something like that, and let the sow stay all day and brought her back that night. And the next morning he goes out and looks, and there were no little pigs. So the next day he goes out and loads her up again in the wheelbarrow and hauls her over to the Brown's farm. So let her stay all day and brought her back that night in the wheelbarrow. And the next morning, the old man was sick and couldn't go out and check. So he asked his wife, says, "Honey, would you go out and see if we have any little pigs?" And the lady says, "Yes." So she went out, and finally she came back in. And he says, "Well, honey, do we have any little pigs?" And she says, "No." Said, "We don't have any little pigs, honey." But said, "The old sow's in the wheelbarrow ready to go." They told me about this time that I should make 12-step calls if I were to have any degree of happy sobriety. So I knew from experience that if you were suffering from alcoholism and you'd been on a drunk and you had a hangover, you needed something probably to ease the pain. So I equipped a little satchel and I put a little bourbon and a little scotch and some yellow jackets and some red birds and a little formaldehyde and a great big bottle of Salpetica. And I thought I was the greatest 12-stepper in Spartanburg. They liked to have broke me because I would make a 12-step call, and all the old hands there that knew what was going on, they'd call me when they wanted a drink. So I finally stopped going to all of them, but finally we had I had a call from one of my very close friends. He was almost like a brother. We had worked for the Spartanburg newspapers before, and he had been drinking a long time, and his mother was in her 90s, and she was like a mother to me. And usually what happened when Roy would start drinking, she would call and say, "Lloyd, come to me." Well, I knew she didn't have to go into details. I knew what was happening. So I called another friend of mine, Ernest P. He's dead now. Ernest, I think, at one time lived in the state of Georgia, in Elberton, I believe. So Ernest was about 75 at that time, and he went with me. So we got our little satchel, and we arrived at Roy's house, and I don't know how Dr. Pilcher or Dr. Mooney or any of those fellows that feel like when they're making a house call, that is, if they ever make one, but anyway, we had the feeling that we were just something special, walking up there with a satchel to help a sick person. And they had stressed to me that this illness was an illness that was extremely bad, and that it, at that time it ranked number 4. That was during Eisenhower's administration. And it had grown down to about number 3 then, I think. And I just knew that it was the worst thing that could ever happen. So we went in, and there Roy was lying in bed. And we looked the situation over and sort of did a little diagnosing, I suppose you'd say. And I said, "Well, Ernest, he doesn't need anything to drink. He's been drunk three weeks now." He says, "That's right." He says, "I'm sure he doesn't need any yellow jackets or Red Bird nor formaldehyde." So I said, "Well, let's try that salopatica." So if you've read the directions on salopatica, it says take 2 teaspoonsful in a glass of water. Well, we got a tablespoon and a big 12-ounce glass, and I put 2 tablespoonsful of salopatica in this glass. And Ernest shook his head and says, "That's not enough for Roy, as sick as he is." So I put 2 more, and I says, "You know, Ernest, Roy is one of the best friends I've ever had." And I said, "I want to see him get straight." And I put 2 more. Then Ernest says, "Well," I said, "if you're going all out like that, put 2 more. I said, "Well, Ernest, that might kill him." He says, "Well, hell, he's no good to anybody anyway." So we put 1 more for just to play safe. That was 9. And we had 2 12-ounce glasses. And he held his head up, and I boxed this back and forth, and you know how it will foam. So we got Roy to drink it, and he like had never gotten his breath, so thought we'd kill him. And then Ernest, with his wisdom, Ernest says, "You know," says, "I have heard, and I don't know for sure, but," said, "after taking something like this, I've heard that a cup of coffee, hot coffee with honey syrup in it, is good to take after the salopatica." So we fixed a cup of coffee and put some honey syrup in it, and we tucked our patient in, and we left, and we felt real good too. The next morning, Ernest called about 8:30, and Ms. Barnett answered the telephone, and Ernest said, "I'd like to speak to Roy." And she said, "Well," said, "I don't know," said, "I doubt very seriously if he's coming." Said, "I'll try," said, "he's had a rough night." So finally Roy came to the telephone, and Ernest, just as nice as a poor fella could be, said, "Roy, how you feeling?" And Roy said, "You go to hell," and hung up on him. I didn't know Roy had called, really. And I called about 30 minutes later. And I said, "Roy, buddy, this is your friend." He said, "You go to hell too, friend," and hung up on me. That really hurt us, in a way. But the moral of it is, we're called in our fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to stay away from the first drink. And that's been 12 years ago. Roy is still sober, hasn't had a drop. And I'm sure beyond a doubt it's a salapatica. And that I like to refer to as undiluted AA. Now, had I given him the alcohol or the pills, I think that would have been diluted AA. Roy's doing a real good job. Now, he is custodian of our club in Spartanburg, and he's doing a tremendous job. I learned during this time in AA, I tried to learn from the old-timers what to do. I finally cut this business out. Of course, I believe if I had the chance and somebody was giving a lot of trouble, I would try this again because I know it works. But some of the old-timers told me, says, "Lloyd," said, "if you're going to be successful," said, you've got to go all out and learn the right things to do and the wrong things to do. And he says, unless you've mopped the walk, you can't talk the talk. And that made sense. And I learned a lot this time in AA. Things have really been good for me. I look upon every day as an extra dividend. So many extra dividends come my way. Of course, sometimes things are not so good. Not long ago, Evelyn was in the den, and I was looking for something. And I went into the girls' room, and the girls are grown now. And one is married, and we have two little old grandchildren. They're in the Philippines. And our youngest daughter, she was off at that time. She was in Daytona teaching school. So I went into the room, and I was looking for something. And I opened the closet door, and there was a compartment above the regular door, and I saw about 8 or 10 dolls. And you know, I have never had such a feeling. I had some time, a good bit of sobriety, seeing these dolls and playthings brought back all the sad memories to me. They brought back the memories of the times when they had to gather up their clothes and leave home and go out in the cold and not knowing whether I would shoot the house up or kill somebody. And I went back into the den and I told my wife, I said, "Evelyn, I wish you would get rid of those dolls." I says, they give me a terrific sad feeling. They bring back all the sad memories. So she says, "Well, I sort of wanted to keep them." Says, "I wanted to keep them as keepsakes." Said, "Our little grandchildren will soon be the age now. They can enjoy them." And to show you how God works in our fellowship, and I'm a firm believer that God is on our side all the time. The next day, we attended an area meeting in Newberry. And it just happened that day, the speaker, somewhere along the way in her talk, said, "If God will forgive you, why can we not forgive ourselves?" And that made more sense to me. I had not forgiven myself for anything. And I started working on this. And From that day on, it has become easier. And it will become easier. I'm a firm believer also that when we ask God for something, we have to be sincere and humble. I think, like somebody once said, if you pray for potatoes, you have to grab a hoe. I think that is the truest thing in the world. I had a little hard time along this way. I had another slip. I had reservations. I was not honest. The most important thing of all is being honest with yourself. And I had reservations, I suppose. My wife was going to Jacksonville, Florida, visiting. And I could hardly wait until she would leave. And the day before she left, I stopped by and got a pint and carried it under the seat of the car until I carried it to the bus station. And the bus was supposed to be there at 9 o'clock, and the blooming thing didn't get there till 10:30. And finally, when I did get home, I told my daughter, youngest daughter, that she should go to bed. And she said, "Well, Daddy says, I'd like to, since Mother's not here, I want to sleep with you tonight." So I said, "No, honey, you better go on to bed." I said, "I plan on staying up and watching the 11 o'clock news and like that." So, you know, I could never convince her and that I should stay up. And she wanted to sleep with me. So finally, I had to give up the idea of drinking that pint. But I still had reservations, and I knew the things to do, and I knew that I should call somebody. I should call a sponsor or eat something sweet, but I avoided all this because I was afraid they would talk me out of it, and I did get on a tremendous drunk. This drunk lasted not too long, about 6 weeks or probably 2 months. During this time, I was confined again in the rest homes and the general hospital in Spartanburg. And again, the fellows and gals in AA put out a welcoming hand to me and said, "Lord says, come on home." Says, "Try it again." Said, "The door is open. It swings both ways." I'm getting a little bit ahead of my story. I'll tell you one thing happened now I can't forget. On this particular drunk, I accused my wife and daughters of giving me such a hard time. Evelyn used to, she even put antabuse in my liquor one time. I was slipping around. Of course, I was, when I say liquor, I meant vodka. I was drinking vodka because I knew that nobody could smell it and I could get by with it. So I slipped in there and got this pint of vodka, and I saw these two antabuse tablets floating around, and I'm thankful I did because it would probably kill me. But one day, the telephone rang, and I had just poured a big drink. This was on Sunday morning, and just as I started to drink it, the telephone rang, and my daughter called me into another room, and I thought whoever was on the telephone would never stop talking. Finally, I went back in and I downed that drink, and I knew the moment it hit my stomach what had happened. Evelyn had poured about 2 ounces of Texas in it. I stayed in bed 4 days and blew bubbles all the time. And then I think the darndest thing had happened. I went in the den one night, and I really wasn't too loaded. This was sort of in the hangover stages. And I went into the den, and they were all sitting there, and the TV was on. And I looked, and I couldn't hear anything. And then they started talking to each other and opening their mouth like that, but no sound. What they had done, they were playing a joke on me. And I said, "Honey, will you talk a little loud? I can't hear." And this went on for about 10 minutes, and I went, got up, and poured all my liquor out. And that was the last drink until I went back into AA. So a lot of things play a part sometimes in our going to AA. I think one of the, I mentioned extra dividends, just looking out here and seeing all these people with, I can tell, this humility in this room, that is an extra dividend to me. I think one of my favorite humility to me is this. Humility is that vital ingredient in a man that makes him feel smaller as he grows greater. And I can see it everywhere I go in AA. And that to me is an extra dividend. One of the best AA talks I ever heard was from a little girl. And this happened during a Thanksgiving meeting. Each member was coming up to the podium and expressing to the group what AA had done for he or she that year. And after everybody had been up, this little girl asked, she was 14 years old, this was an open meeting, and says, "Could I say a few words?" And the chairman stepped back because this was most unusual. And the little girl says, "I would like to thank all of you wonderful people for giving my father back to my mother and my sister and I." She says, "Our home is what it used to be." Says, "We're happy now. We don't have to leave." And said, "Most important of all, there's love in our home." And she was crying. And as I looked around the group, it seemed that most everybody in there had tears in their eyes. I especially had tears because I was the chairman that night, and that was Brenda, my oldest daughter. To me, that was one of the best talks I ever heard. Our other little white-headed girl, Melanie, was about 4 years behind Brenda. And when she was in high school, she liked to sort of participate in extracurriculars. And she was a cheerleader. And oh, she loved that. And Evelyn and I became real sports fans because we would go to the football games and the basketball games just to see her perform. And I know all the other cheerleaders were doing a tremendous job, but to us, to me, I suppose, I only saw Melanie. So one night, during the homecoming game, out on the football field at halftime, they were having the exercises and they were crowning the homecoming queen and they were taking pictures and presenting bouquets and like that. And all of a sudden, I saw Melanie pointing, and she was talking to one of her friends and said, "There's my daddy." And to me, that was the greatest thing I think I can ever remember. I have the love of Melanie, and I could sort of imagine what maybe she should be saying. She'll say, "There's my daddy. And he's so proud of me being out here tonight in the limelight." But it was the other way around. She was saying, "There's my daddy, and I'm so proud of him because he has made our home like it used to be or what it should be." That, too, is an extra dividend. I'm going to start closing now. I know I've talked probably too long. All of you are familiar with the great and wonderful Helen Keller and what she stood for and what she did. And someone once asked her what her handicap had meant to her. And she says, "Through my handicap, I have found myself. And through my handicap, I have found the work I like to do. And through my handicap, I have found my God." And I like to compare things. And I think through my handicap as an alcoholic, through my handicap, I have to a degree found myself. God knows I have a long, long ways to go. Through my handicap, I have found sort of how to do a few things that may help somebody when I make a 12-step call. At least it strengthens my sobriety. And I love every bit of it. Through my handicap as an alcoholic, I found my God. And when things really get real rough, and I think, well, nobody cares anymore, and I feel sorry for myself, and self-pity sets in, and resentment, remorse, and all that sort of thing, I like to think of a little old poem I like to remember, and I will try to quote it. And it goes something like this. Today, upon a bus, I saw a lovely girl with golden hair. I envied her, she seemed so gay, and wished that I were as fair. When suddenly she rose to leave, I watched her hobble down the aisle. She had one leg and wore a crutch, and as she passed, a smile. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two legs, the world is mine. And as I stopped to buy some sweets, the lad who sold them had such charm. I talked with him, he seemed so glad, if I were late, could do no harm. And as I left, he said to me, I thank you, you've been so kind. It's nice to talk to folks like you. You see, he says, I'm blind. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two eyes, the world is mine. Later, walking down the street, I saw a child with eyes of blue. He stood and watched the others play. It seemed he knew not what to do. I stopped, and then I said, why don't you join the others, dear? He looked straight ahead without a word, and then I knew he could not hear. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two ears, the world is mine. With legs to take me where I would go, with eyes to see the sunset glow, with ears to hear what I would know, oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I am blessed indeed. The world is mine. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.